Just Life, a programme from Radio Maria England.
Good morning to all our listeners. This is Radio Maria. I'm Eddie Zengeni, and as you've just heard in the introduction, this is Just Life. And today we have a very special guest and friend of ours here at Radio Maria. It's Claire Coquelin, and she's here to speak about her passion, which is New Testament Greek. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning, Eddie.
Great. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Right, great. We've made it work, which is great. And you're here this morning, as I said in the introduction, to talk about one of your passions, which is New Testament Greek.
Yes.
Right. So, yes. First of all, before we dive in, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and perhaps how you got involved in being here this morning as well?
Sure. So I am a lay Catholic woman, married, with two children, a 12-year-old son and a 14-year-old daughter. And we live about half an hour outside Cambridge, but our lives are very Cambridge-centred, and we attend Mass at Blackfriars Priory, which is where you and I met, Eddie.
There
and you said, come along and do this show.
That's
and
right.
Tell me about a passion, and then maybe you slightly regretted what you got, but there we are.
I was expecting gardening
Exactly. But I do like gardening as well. But, it's been really interesting to think about the fact that actually this really is a passion of mine, and to try and think about why that is and explain it so that makes sense. So I'll try to explain sort of chronologically how I got into it, and that might help a bit. So I used to practice as a solicitor, and I worked doing that for about 16 years. But when I had children, I went part-time, and eventually I stopped doing that altogether so that I could spend more time with my children. And it suited our family to have me keep the domestic show on the road. But I did have a little bit of extra time. And I'd always wanted to study some theology. And when we moved to Cambridge from Norfolk about 4 years ago...
Is that where you're from? Is it that way?
Well, we'd lived there. No, not originally. I'm from Hertfordshire originally.
Okay.
And my husband is from the Netherlands. But for about 15 years, we lived in Norfolk working there. And then we came to Cambridge and our children are at school here. And I had this time, and my lovely husband was very supportive of the idea of my doing some further study. And very providentially, just down the road from my children's school was is the Margaret Beaufort Institute of Theology, mm-hmm. which, as many of your listeners already know, is a Catholic institution which resources lay people theologically. And so it has a huge range of courses, from one-off lectures and workshops through to short informal courses, all the way through to more formal MAs and PhDs. So if you don't know about it, check it out, because it really is an amazing resource for lay Catholics, full of inspirational teachers who really nurture their students. So I did a few courses and they were thrilling. But I soon also experienced some frustration because I didn't have any theological training and I didn't understand a lot of the terminology that was being used. And I just really wanted to understand more about how it all fitted together. And I had a moment of clarity where I realised if I was going to sort of make any headway with that, then I really needed to do a formal course, and that would introduce some fear, basically, in the form of essays and exams.
Right.
Because, you're not going to write an essay voluntarily, is it?
No, you need a bit of pressure, don't you? Yeah.
In amongst all the domestic busyness. So that's when I applied for something called the DTM, or Diploma in Theology for Ministry. And so I will get on to Greek in a minute, but this is
great.
All relevant context,
I'm sure.
Which I hopefully will become clear. So what the diploma is a one-year foundation course in theology. Although you can study it part-time over 2 years, which I did and would highly recommend because, frankly, it didn't feel part-time. it felt like a part-time course, a full-time course over 2 years. And it was when I started doing that course that I realised that learning an ancient scriptural language, so in the case of Christian theology, that's Hebrew for the Old Testament or Greek for the New Testament, is a thing. And that it's considered valuable when studying theology. I hadn't really appreciated that before. Mm-hmm. So I opted to take this paper in elementary New Testament Greek in my first year. I really loved it. And then I chose to continue in my second year to do intermediate New Testament Greek. And I've now finished the diploma, but I'm currently auditing the third year undergraduate New Testament Greek paper at the university, which means I'm attending the classes and preparing for the paper, but I'm not actually going to be sitting the exam. I just want to say a little bit more about the diploma, because it occurs to me there may even be some listeners out there who are thinking, I want to do this.
Yeah,
I want to learn
that,
New Testament Greek.
I was actually thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
This is a great platform for
exactly.
maybe attracting our listeners to to deepen their knowledge on the faith. Yeah.
So you don't have to have studied any theology before. It's a University of Cambridge award, which is pretty exciting because it means you get to access some of the teaching at the Divinity Faculty here in Cambridge, which is
great, yeah.
You know, really wonderful level. But at the same time, it's designed to be for confessing Christians. It's designed in collaboration with the Cambridge Theological Federation, which is a collaboration of 12 different theological institutions, including the Margaret Beaufort Institute, which teach theology for ministry. So in an Anglican context, you know, that means ministry with a capital M. Mm. And so there were a lot of ordinands right. on the course. That's not the case, obviously, for lay Catholics who are there exploring ministry with a small M. Mm-hmm. But it's really beautiful, actually, the CTF. It's a really genuinely ecumenical environment where everybody's respective traditions and denominations are respected and everyone's learning together.
I'm sure.
You're all just, you know, pleased to be on this journey together.
How long was the course?
Well, you can do it. It's 1 year, but you can do it over two. A lot of the ordinands are doing a longer course, the BTH, Bachelor in Theology, which is a three-year degree, but you can't do that part-time. So that,
okay.
You know, but it's the same thing, but twice the amount as the diploma. And as I mentioned, you know, it's from the perspective of a confessing Christian. So that may sound fairly obvious, but actually, you know, obviously there are different perspectives from which to approach Christian theology. But the approach of the diploma is that there's a commitment to the main lines of classic Christian testimony to God. And that means that there's a priority given to your Christian perspective, but you're entering into a wide range of dialogues and correlations with other disciplines and frameworks to try and illuminate the Christian perspective. So think St. Anselm, faith seeking understanding. It's for people who have an active love of God, who are seeking a deeper knowledge of God.
Okay.
So the reason why I'm speaking a bit about the theological context for studying New Testament Greek is because fundamentally the reason why studying New Testament Greek is in fact inseparable from why study Christian theology, because it's, of course, the language in which the New Testament writings were written. Mm-hmm. And the main reason for studying it is to gain a deeper understanding of Scripture and to engage with questions of meaning, truth, beauty, religious practice. It's deeply rewarding and enjoyable. I wish I had more time for it. It's my passion. And it's the first thing I thought of. Sorry, not gardening. when you said, come and talk about passion. And I want to try to explain what it is that I find so satisfying about it.
It's quite a challenge, though, doesn't it, to study ancient Greek?
You have to kind of like languages. Mm. You have to enjoy the sort of just the process of learning a language. Mm. If at school languages were you hated them, then maybe this is not for you.
Right.
But if you quite like them, then yeah, it's fun.
Okay. All right. Sounds so far very fun.
So shall I go on to talk about the Greek now?
Yeah, why not? Just a couple of minutes. We'll do a little introduction to it and then we'll have a little music break.
Okay. So a lot of people ask me, what's the difference between New Testament Greek and classical ancient Greek? They're essentially the same language, but that question depends on what kind of classical Greek you're talking about, because classical Greek is a sort of umbrella term for different dialects and periods. So if we're talking about 8th century Homeric Greek, then it's quite different. But if we're talking about 5th century Attic Greek, so that's the Greek of Plato and Aristotle, okay, all the great playwrights, then it's the same language, but it's from a later date. It's the language that was spoken in the 1st and 2nd century in the Greek-speaking Mediterranean world. It's simpler grammar, shorter sentences. There are innovations and new vocabulary that you don't find in Attic Greek, but because what you're talking about is a subset in terms of vocabulary of the wider language, because obviously there's a limited amount of vocabulary in the New Testament, is often perceived to be simpler or easier.
It's
easier,
basically. Attic Greek, yeah?
Yes. So that's, that's sort of, think Plato, Aristotle.
Okay. So this is like an evolution of that.
Yes.
Which makes sense because it came after.
Yeah. Right. It's sort of in between that Greek and modern Greek.
Okay, got you. It's an in-between, again makes sense chronologically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You're having to learn a different alphabet and you're having to learn different syntax and you're having to learn vocabulary, but it's actually quite manageable. To put it in perspective, on the course, we spent 2 terms learning the rudiments of the language, the alphabet, the grammar, and some vocabulary. And by that stage, we were then up and running sufficiently to be able to start tackling some of the texts and start trying to translate some of them. Obviously, like any ancient language, you're not trying to speak it or write it unless you're massively keen. You're trying to decipher the word on the page. Mm-hmm. We went along to these classes as a group. We had wonderful teachers, a great textbook. It was great fun starting a language right from the very beginning. And then pretty quickly, you're up and running and looking at some of the set texts. And we started with Gospel of John, which is considered one of the easier starting points, not theologically.
I was going to say, try reading Book of Revelations in ancient
just
Greek.
There's a sort of slightly smaller vocabulary than in the Synoptic Gospels and shorter sentences.
Okay.
So,
right.
From a translation point of view, it's more perceived to be more accessible. And then we moved on in our second year to look at Gospel of Mark,
okay,
and St. Paul's letter to the Galatians,
okay,
which made a really lovely foil to each other. And now in the third year, we're looking at some of the Catholic epistles, so Jude, James, and 1 Peter. And there, the Greek is a bit more sophisticated. You're getting a more literary style of Greek with more complicated grammatical structures.
Great. Well, that's amazing. We're going to have a little music break now. And what song have you chosen for us this morning?
The first song I've chosen is Love and Affection by Joan Armatrading, which is just a very feel-good song.
All right.
Thank you.
Radio Maria, very warm welcome back this morning to our Just Life. And we have here, live in our studio in Cambridge, Claire Kokala. And she's been speaking to us today about a very passionate topic. And, well, it's a real challenge she's undertaken, but it seems like she's really enjoying it. And it's New Testament, Ancient Greek.
Yes. Yes.
So let us resume.
Okay. So now I'm going to try to explain why on earth you would bother. why not just read the Bible in English with commentaries?
Pass my mind.
Okay. So I've got two answers to this, both of which I'll expand on. The first one is to get as close as possible to the truth of Scripture.
Of course, yeah.
And the second one, because it's delightful, which... you know, it might be a harder sell, but I'll come on to that. Okay. So, to get as close to the great truths of Scripture as possible. The first point I wanted to make is that close wrestling with the original text allows us to see how we have been shaped in our understanding of it by centuries of translations, interpretations, and associations. There's layers and layers and layers between us as the reader and that original text. And readers make meaning. So all of those commentators over the centuries have brought something to the party. They've brought their interests, their goals, their unique perspectives to their exegesis. And in fact, the scriptures themselves have made meaning out of the words and actions of Jesus. So it's not possible to adopt a neutral position in relation to some pure text. Everyone stands somewhere. And as we'll go on to talk about, the text of scripture is more elusive than one might think from reading a single translation. But you wouldn't want to turn your back on these rich layers of interpretations which have shaped our understanding of scripture over the centuries. We need them. We need all those perspectives, theological, historical, linguistic, sociocultural, in order to access its meaning. We can't do it on our own, but we do need to weigh them up and work out where we stand. And it's much easier to try and weigh up all those competing, conflicting perspectives and see where we stand in relation to them if we can appeal to the original text.
Okay.
So that's the first point. You know, I sort of see the Greek text sometimes as a sort of anchor, a port in the storm of all of these competing, conflicting interpretations. And translation, this is a sort of a related point. As soon as you're reading the text in translation, you have another layer of interpretation between you and the original text, because the Greek language doesn't map neatly onto English. It has a different syntax. Greek words don't always convey the same meaning as the equivalent English word. Most of them have multiple possible meanings anyway, and you have to play around with words, and you have to look at how they're used in different contexts, in other texts of the period, to try to decide on the right English word or phrase. And obviously, the major translations have all done this, and experts have been involved, and they probably do a darn sight better job than one is doing as a sort of student of New Testament Greek. But nonetheless, there are differences between them, and so to work out where you stand, you have to weigh them up. You have to read them, work out the differences and why one of them is saying one thing and one another. So in order to assess the merits of different translations, it's helpful to be able to appeal to the Greek text. And to understand what a translator is trying to do with a particular word. There are so many different options for rendering Greek into English. So imagine you're sitting there, you've got a dictionary in one hand, you've got your grammar in the other, you've got the text of some of the most popular translations on standby for when you get stuck. And you imagine you're going to reveal the meaning, and then you quickly realise that almost every single word, certainly with every slightly larger unit of meaning, phrase or subclause, never mind a sentence, that you have to make a choice about which English word to use and what to reject and what order to put them in order to try to do justice to this Greek original text you've got sitting in front of you. And then the Greek text itself is not always stable. So one thing I've learned on the course is that there are about apparently 5,500 to 6,000 handwritten documents of copies of the New Testament known today. And that number is continuing to increase as more manuscripts are discovered.
In ancient Greek.
Fragments, right. Not whole, mm-hmm. whole copies of the New Testament, probably now it's quite rare to it would be quite unusual to discover a whole text of the New Testament now, but there are still fragments being translated all the time, and there's hardly a sentence of the New Testament that has the exact same wording in all of those exemplars. And that's because over 14 centuries of manuscript transmission, texts have been recopied, copied by hand, scribes and editors have revised the text deliberately to increase readability, avoid misunderstandings, adapt expressions to the vernacular. Words have been omitted, inserted, changed by mistake, because it's actually quite difficult to copy out the whole of the New Testament mm-hmm. by hand without making any error. And so the Greek New Testament that I'm talking about, that we were introduced to on the course, that the scholarly version that that people use, called the Nestle-Aland version 28, is a reconstruction of the initial text. So there is a committee, an international editorial committee, that has attempted to discern which of all these existing variants document the oldest form of the New Testament, which of them originated later. And it's constantly being revised as new manuscripts are discovered, new methodological insights emerge. So sometimes, you know, you have to make a decision about which textual variant to adopt, and how to translate a particular word or phrase can change the meaning of the text quite significantly. So I thought I would try, if you can bear with me, I thought I would try to illustrate this problem, in inverted commas. I'll come on in a minute to why I think it's a blessing in disguise, with an example I puzzled over recently.
Such a positive outlook you've got.
In the Epistle of Jude. So this is Jude verse 22 to 23. So it's in the closing section of the letter. The writer uses a series of imperatives to exhort his recipients to act in a particular, e.g. loving way, towards some different groups of people. So here's the ESV, or English Standard Version, translation. And have mercy on those who doubt. Save others by snatching them out of the fire. To others, show mercy with fear, hating even the garment stained by the flesh. So you've got three groups of people in this version: doubters, who are shown mercy, another group, who are to be saved from the fire, and a third group, to be shown a different sort of mercy, mercy with fear. So the word that has been translated here as doubters, diakronomenos, is the Greek word, can also mean the ones under judgment, or it can mean the ones who dispute. So already a question arises as to what precisely is the character of this first group. Are they doubters? Are they ones under judgment? Or are they ones who dispute? And then the plot thickens further when you discover, from the textual apparatus at the bottom of your Greek New Testament, this is a sort of key which helps orient you around different manuscript variants, that there's quite strong textual support for a different verb for mercy. That first example of mercy, which in Greek is eleate, could in fact be elekete, which doesn't mean have mercy. It means reprove. So instead of have mercy on the doubters, you might have reprove those who dispute. Exactly. And perhaps that's an idea akin to the idea in Matthew 18, where Christ teaches, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault. So, you know, it's perfectly...
That's a good example, that one, the mercy and the...
Yeah, so you begin to see the issue. And in fact, this is just the beginning of the problems with these particular two verses, because as I understand it, the text of this section is notoriously unstable and it's full of ambiguity. What is mercy with fear, one might ask? What does it mean to say hating even the garment stained by the flesh?
Yeah.
Anyway, I was
pro-second that when you were telling me.
I'm not going to go there. But, okay, but basically what I'm trying to say is, if as Christians we believe that God through Jesus has given us instructions on how to love, it really does matter what that love looks like. And it behoves us to try and understand that message with the aid of the Spirit, of course, but also using all the powers of reason available to us. But I promise why I would also tell you why all of this uncertainty is, in fact, a blessing in disguise. Okay. So the example I've given you is a bit unhelpful in this respect, because, as I say, it's one of the most corrupt passages in the whole New Testament, and it's probably impossible, in fact, to reach an assured conclusion about the original text. There's a completely baffling array of versions in the manuscripts. I wouldn't want you to have the impression that all of the New Testament is that unstable.
Okay. So you went to a very...
I did. Yeah. I went to a wobbly bit. But the point I wanted to make is the fact that decisions have to be made when you're translating constantly about which word to use and how is helpful. because it forces you to really grapple with the text.
Okay.
And the reason for that is the only way to resolve the ambiguities, or to try to the best you possibly can, is to look at each word really carefully in its context and see what company it keeps. What does the immediate context tell us? Has the writer used it somewhere else in the same text? If so, in what context? Where else does the word appear in the New Testament, or in a wider Semitic or Greco-Roman context? What was its reception by the church fathers or in later periods?
Okay.
What is the genre of the text? Mm-hmm. Is it parable, letter, testimony, prophecy, prayer? Who was the author? What was his intention?
Mm-hmm.
What's the historical context? How did the society work? Its culture, its social psychology, its economic and political systems? All of that has to be brought into the mix. So the translation of every single unit of meaning involves this drawing together constantly as best we can of the text as a whole. And it's through this process of wrestling constantly that we become aware of its resonances, and key theological insights spring up. And they're, of course, tentative and in some cases speculative, and one becomes horribly aware of the limits of one's own understanding. But the more you put in, the more the text gives back.
Great. Wow. That was amazing. And thank you for a very insightful second half of that talk there. It's starting to cement and solidify in my mind now. And so let's have another piece of music. And what do we have next?
So this is Shirley, the wonderful actress Shirley Henderson, singing a piece from The Mikado, The Sun Whose Rays Are All Ablaze. And maybe there are more technically assured renditions of this song by famous opera singers, but I really, really love this version because there's such fragility to it. She plays a tragic figure, an actress, a famous Gilbert and Sullivan actress who was an alcoholic, but a genius actress. It's a beautiful piece.
This is Radio Maria, and very warm welcome back. You're listening to Just Life, and we're having a very interesting talk here on New Testament, Ancient Greek with Claire Coquelin. And I'm really quite impressed by the example that you gave in the second half of the talk, because it was a question that I was going to ask, but obviously I like to let the speaker speak and not interrupt. But you answered it without me having to ask, and that was you gave a brilliant example of what would be, as you saw, a wobbly part of the New Testament where one word could be interpreted two ways, and each way is not quite the same as the other. And then how, as a student of the New Testament in Greek, you have to pull in all these different strings and different elements. Mm-hmm. And we were just saying while the music was on, it's almost like archaeology for an ancient text that you have to sort of dust off things and put things in the context when they were written. Mm. How much of an influence had this had on your faith? Because I'm imagining if I was put in a position under pressure with an exam as well, to study as well, and a push to write essays and things, that you've been grappling over these things, perhaps at 3 o'clock in the morning, your mind's going, what does it really mean? And there's all these different interpretations that you've been saying, these competing and conflicting interpretations. And did this push you spiritually?
Definitely. I wish I could think of a good example of that, but it's definitely the case that the more effort you put in to try to draw all these strands together and get your head around the meaning of the text, the more beauty you see in it. But I think it's also true to say that the text works on you as well. And it has imaginative and practical implications for you as the reader. And it can, and it should be transformative as it, the world of meaning in the text interacts with your whole world of meaning and truth and beauty. I wish I could think of a specific example, but don't put me on the spot with that one.
No.
Trust me, that is definitely the case. Mm. And I suppose it brings me on to the other reason why I study New Testament Greek that I wanted to say, which because it's just delightful. You know, there are so many references in the Psalms, aren't there, to the joy of meditating on God's law day and night.
Yes, there are.
And so here's a line from Psalm 119. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Because the Greek text is so beautiful. And each text has its own unique style. And much of the language is beautifully crafted in a way that's very difficult to replicate in an English translation. So the letter of James, which we're looking at the moment, for example, is very sophisticated literary Greek, full of alliteration, assonances, and these chiastic structures and wordplay, which not only help you to interpret the text by lending emphasis and pointing to particular word pairings or antitheses that help your understanding of it, but can also just be appreciated for their own sake. Mm,
sure.
And I also wanted to say, in a sort of less highfalutin sounding note, that another reason I love it is just great fun. It's like a puzzle. If you like jigsaw puzzles or Sudoku, I'm not very good at Sudoku, but some people like that. That it's a bit addictive is what I'm saying. Mm. That it's a joy just to be able to get your text out and puzzle away. Mm. And another image that I wanted to share with you is that I keep thinking of as I've been talking about this, thinking about preparing to speak today. As I was a child growing up, we had on the mantelpiece one of those little crystal prisms. Do you know what I mean? Like a multi-faced crystal ball thing. Mm-hmm. And I used to stare into it as a child, and it diffracts the light in all sorts of different directions. But you keep staring into it because you kind of want to see what's inside it.
Right.
So it's a bit like that.
You just,
it's not, I don't find it disorienting. I find it compelling and it definitely strengthens my faith. Yes.
Great. So all these competing and conflicting interpretations, is there one official interpretation of New Testament, ancient Greek? Is that the one official? This is what it is. We've been studying it more than anyone else. You can have a little bit of nuance here and there.
No.
Okay.
No. So a resource that I use a lot when I'm translating, there's a website, BibleHub.com. There are other websites that you can go to, but this one has this lovely function where you can click on parallel and up come about 20 different translations of the particular verse you're translating, all underneath one another, so that you can easily see the differences. And I tend to go to the ESV, first of all, the English Standard Version, which is known for being reliable and close to the Greek. And then I often compare it with one of the very literal translations, which sometimes can sound a bit like Yoda speak.
Right.
but, you know, it's helpful to just check, okay, so how have they got that from that? And then maybe I'll throw in the Dewey Rouse, the Knox translation, because I like the expressions there. But So
you compare and contrast three different interpretations and then decide what you think
And then I see what my sort of very noddy translation has come up with and how it fits in, and then maybe I'll borrow a word here or there from somebody else. I think, oh no, that word's better.
All right. Well, it's great that you're given the opportunity to have that flexibility and freedom to interpret it the way you see fit, obviously, after.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But sorry, what I should have said is that when you are choosing words, you're rejecting words at the same time, but you carry those alternatives in your head. So even though you have to, if you're rendering a text into English, you have to pick a word. You don't have to pick a word in your head. You can still hold all these other potential meanings in your mind. So you've got that richer understanding.
And at least you know what they are. Yeah.
This sort of tentative process all the time. And you're not committing to a particular version. You can play around with it and maybe change your mind.
Wow. Great. Do you think there's a... Some people might run a risk of getting sort of caught in a trap between the tiny nuances and discrepancies in the New Testament, and kind of maybe get lost looking at focusing just on one particular nuance without embracing the whole idea. Do you think that people might run a risk of perhaps
possibly
over analyzing things? Yeah, and you know, because obviously
it's academia. Are you calling me a pedant?
No, absolutely not. But you know what I mean.
So I do, and this is where you know, we're so blessed to have this whole universe of scholarship out there. I mean, there are some extraordinary commentaries, and I'm just a babe in the woods there, but there are some really useful tools out there that can help to put all those things in perspective, and have, you know, people who've spent their lives studying these things who can contextualize all of these points and put them in a theological context and help to draw it together. So you never need to feel lost, and you don't need to go down a rabbit hole. You can sort of pull yourself back up again and reorient yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Great. We're going to have one more piece of music, and then I think it'd be a good idea if you'd perhaps explain to our listeners after this piece of music what they should do if they have a vocation to study New Testament ancient Greek. How about that? And we've got a bit of Astrid Gilberta coming up next, I believe. Is that right?
Yes.
All right.
It's the start of spring.
I'm as restless as a willow in a windstorm. I'm as jumping as a puppet on a string. I'd say that I have spring fever, but I know it isn't spring. I'm as starry-eyed and vaguely discontented, like a nightingale without a song to sing. Why should I have spring fever when I know it isn't spring? I keep wishing I were somewhere else, walking from a man I'm yet to meet. I'm as busy as a spider spinning daydreams. I'm as giddy as a baby on a swing. Haven't seen a crocus or a rosebud or a robin on the wing, but I feel so gay in a melancholy way that it might as well be spring. Oh, that it might as well. Thank you. wishing I were somewhere else, walking down a strange new street, hearing words that I have never heard from a man I'm yet to meet. I'm as busy as a spider spinning daydreams. I'm as giddy as a baby on a swing. I haven't seen a crocus or a rosebud or a robin on the wing, but I feel so gay in a melancholy way that it might as well be spring. Oh, that it might as well be spring.
This is Radio Maria. Very warm welcome back. That's Astrid Gilberto and Stan Getz, and it might as well be spring. Chosen by our guest this morning, Claire Kokola, who's been here giving us a very interesting talk on New Testament ancient Greek. And I remember when we first came up with the idea and I asked Claire if she'd grace us with her presence here in the studio for a topic of her choice. I was a bit overwhelmed. I thought, this is, as your husband Sebastian said the other day, this is all Greek to me. So, but I've learned a lot. I've learned, definitely it's been a wonderful introduction for anyone who wants to deepen their faith and really get to grips with it. I think also at the beginning of the talk, when you said there's all these interpretations and the hundreds of different translations over the centuries, all with a different nuanced influence perhaps. And if you really want to get to the heart of it, go back to the original text. And that's what you've done boldly and successfully. How difficult was it? Let's talk the mechanics and the logistics, the grammar and the different letters and everything like that. How long did it take you to memorize them? Because it's obviously not a Latin-based language.
Yeah. Well, I should say that I still very much have the use of a dictionary and a grammar book by my side. Mm-hmm. I haven't kept it all in my head, but there's a fantastic textbook that we use, that they use at the university here. It's by a gentleman called Jeremy Duff, and it's called Elements of New Testament Greek.
Okay.
So if you're wanting to dip your toe in, you could just get a copy and work your way through it, because it's really systematic. It starts right at the beginning with the alphabet.
Okay.
And each time it introduces a new subject, it gives you exercises to work through.
Oh, okay.
I found it incredibly user-friendly. It was also helpful. So in the class, we did what I first thought was sort of quite an old-fashioned sort of style of teaching. The teacher would be standing there with a whiteboard rather than a blackboard, so I guess it wasn't that old-fashioned, writing verb endings up on the board, and we would recite them, which I'd never really done before, but was incredibly helpful because with the myriad of verb endings, it helps to recite them. And if you're then walking your dog, you can be conjugating
as you go, yeah.
And there are all sorts of brilliant apps and things you can use today. Memrise has all the vocabulary from the Jeremy Duff books, for example. So a bit like Duolingo, you can be sort of pinging away if you're sitting at the bus station or something. And so if you like that process of learning a language, it's actually really manageable because, as I say, unlike a modern language where you're going to have to sort of order things in a cafe, you're never going to have to speak, you're never going to have to write it. You're learning to be able to decipher it. And once you've worked your way through that textbook, you've got a lot of the vocabulary you'll need. If you want to be taught, then you could do what I did. You could go and apply and do the diploma. It's really deeply rewarding. And that helps because, of course, you've got then a very structured approach. We had, I think, 3 one-hour classes a week on Greek, and you're doing it together, and you're told, go away and learn this lot of vocabulary by the next time. So it keeps the momentum going. But you could possibly do it on your own.
Right, yeah.
With the help of this textbook, actually.
Okay. If any of our listeners wanted to sign up and do a course, let's say from scratch, let's say they're living in the Cambridge area and they wanted to go in physically, which course would you recommend?
Go and talk to the Margaret Beaufort Institute.
Right.
I don't know what other courses may be out there, mm-hmm. but that's the one I know about. Mm-hmm. And they're incredibly supportive and nurturing. So I wouldn't have done what I had done were it not for them, because it was an email from their then director of studies, Dr. Amy Dalton, who's in Birmingham now, who just emailed me and said, you know, had you thought about studying some theology?
Okay.
I think you'd
so
like it.
So it was recommended to you by someone else, and
yeah,
they put
because,
the seed
because
in
because they're really, they notice individuals and they want to support you in your studies.
Nurture
and in
the
your
talent,
faith
yeah.
journey. And there's a whole range of different ages and backgrounds, people who apply to do the diploma to. The diploma, I mean, it's called the Diploma in Theology for Ministry. It has this practical element. Part of the purpose of it is you're thinking all the time about how is what you're learning going to be of use to the church? And I don't have an answer to that question yet, I'm afraid, with regards myself.
We might have to get you back on then once you've found the answer there. Well, listen, we're coming to the end of our programme now. I've had a very fascinating hour with you and I've learned a lot. And you certainly put a few seeds in my mind, which will hopefully grow. And I hope the same thing applies to our listeners as well. So once more, thank you very much, Claire, for joining us. Really appreciate it. And I'll probably see you again very soon at Mass.
Yeah.
All right.
Great to chat.
Okay. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. This is Radio Maria.